is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Pursuant to the previous announcement that all civil servants should be vaccinated, Cabinet further resolved that no unvaccinated civil servants will be allowed to come to work.
That's Zimbabwe's Information Minister, Monica Musvangwa, on the government's new ban on unvaccinated civil servants going to work. Details coming up. Also, in the upcoming South African elections in November, polls show the ruling African National Congress could lose power in several cities. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. A court in Kigali has found opposition leader Paul Rusesabagina guilty of terror charges and sentenced him to 25 years in prison. Rusesabagina became famous for his effort to protect hundreds of people during Rwanda's 1994 genocide, which became the basis for the film Hotel Rwanda. He later became a vocal critic of Rwandan President Paul Kagame and left the country in 1996. He was a founder of the Rwandan Movement for Democratic Change. Kagame's government accused him of supporting the National Liberation Front, or FLN, which is blamed for attacks that killed 9 people in 2018 and 2019. The FLN is seen as a militant wing of the MRDC. Rusesabagina denied involvement in the attacks, and his supporters say the case against him is politically motivated. However, reporter Eugene Uwimana in Kigali tells VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson that many people in the country think that Rusesabagina was guilty.
Judges today of the High Court Chamber for International and Cross-Border Crimes started the reading verdict around 11 a.m. Kigali time in the case where Paul Rusesabagina is charged of 13 charges, including terrorism, financing and founding armed groups, murder, arson, and conspiracy to involve children in armed groups. And, you know, the prosecution was seeking life sentence. But what happened today is that the court found Rusesabagina's role in creating FLN, that's a military wing of MRCD, the party Paul Rusesabagina was president of. And the court found his provision of funds and purchasing for them secure phones to use all constitute the crime of committing terrorism. So therefore, the court found him culpable of the crime of terrorism. The court also found him guilty of financing terrorism as a crime under the Rwandan penal law. It is punishable with between 7 to 10 years in prison and a fine of 3 to 5 times the contribution made by the convicted individual. And the court also found a channel through which FLN was being funded and concluded that Rusesabagina was one of its funders. The court also found no basis in claims by Rusesabagina and Calixt Sankara, who was the spokesperson of FLN, that the aim for creating FLN was to facilitate repatriation of Rwandans in exile. So the court found no basis. So the court, the judges said the atrocities committed by this group is completely different from the mandate they claim they had. Finally, the court found Rusesabagina also guilty of committing and being complicit to terror acts.
His supporters and attorneys have said that he was forcibly brought to Kigali and that these allegations, these charges, are politically motivated. Did the court respond to those positions?
The court didn't, the court didn't respond to that. In some of interactions, the government officials have been having said that the important thing is not the way he was brought here, but the important thing is what he did. And in courtrooms, in some of court hearings, victims of the attacks he allegedly carried out were present in courts, and some of them were demanding reparations. So the question of bringing him in Rwanda was not discussed.
Has there been any reaction out on the streets in Kigali, or have people not really been paying attention?
People have been paying attention a lot. On social media, you can see it because the trial is being live streamed online. The Supreme Court provided YouTube link so that people can follow online wherever they are. So on social media, on Twitter, people are commenting. Some of them saying that this trial is fair, that Rusesa Bagina is getting what he deserves, and of course, some others saying that it is not fair.
Now, can the defendants in the case, Mr. Rusesabagina and the other co-defendants, appeal this verdict?
Yes, they can, because they are being tried by the High Court Chamber for International and Cross-Border Crimes, which means that they still have another ladder. They still have the Court of Appeal. Rwanda have the Court of Appeal. So if their lawyers think they didn't get a fair verdict, they are allowed to appeal.
That was journalist Eugene Uwimana from Kigali speaking with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson. Rusesabagina and 20 others are charged with 13 criminal offenses for their alleged connection to the FLN, the militia group that the Rwandan government accuses of released alleged terrorism. WhatsApp chat messages, which they say were retrieved from Rusesabagina's Belgian phone number. One of the messages talked about the purchase of military-grade weapons, including rocket-propelled grenades, missiles, and hand grenades. Kate Gibson is one of Rusesabagina's lawyers from Geneva, Switzerland. She told VOA's James Butty that Rusesabagina's family and his lawyers have concluded that the trial did not meet international standards for fairness. She says international monitors of the trial have come to the same conclusion.
Can you elaborate? What do you mean that he did not receive a fair trial?
International conventions to which Rwanda is a party, which Rwanda has signed, set out minimum standards of fair trial rights that must be afforded to anyone who's accused of a crime anywhere in the world. And these are basic rights such as the right to legal assistance, the right to adequate time and facilities to prepare, and the right to be presumed innocent. And we see, even in days after Paul's arrest, high-ranking members of the Rwandan authorities, including the president, came out and said that Paul was guilty. That's a violation of his right to be presumed innocent. But more than that, Paul wasn't given a copy of his case file. He wasn't allowed to prepare for the trial. His lawyers weren't allowed to bring materials into him. Any legal documents that they tried to discuss with him were confiscated and were read at the highest levels of government. Paul wasn't allowed to have the lawyers of his choosing. The violations of his rights basically read as a checklist of all the things that you shouldn't do to an accused.
That was attorney Kate Gibson in Geneva speaking with James Botti, the host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. 3 months after Ethiopia's national election, the conflict in the Tigray region continues. Ali Verji studies the Horn of Africa for the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. He tells VOA's Kate Bond-Dawson the sanctions regime the United States announced last week is unlikely to change the situation.
Not much has changed in the overall dynamics of the conflict. There's still fighting going on. There's still a desire by both sides to pursue a military solution. The territorial gains have gone back and forth, but it doesn't seem like there is any imminent end to the fighting.
Now, the U.S. Has announced new sanctions. Can they help, or can sanctions from other countries help change the situation?
Well, what the U.S. has announced so far is more of a sanctions regime, the possibility, rather than anything more tangible. And so probably in the short term, nobody in Ethiopia is that worried about this announcement, although there has been, of course, a reaction which was highly negative towards the announcement. I don't think this in and of itself is going to shift the calculus of the parties in the conflict.
What is needed at this point to, as you say, shift the calculus, to bring an end to this fighting?
I don't think there's a single option for what is needed or what will solve the conflict. Clearly, both parties have still determined that fighting is in their interests. And so until that changes, it's very difficult for anyone outside to influence that sort of belief.
So then at this situation, it looks like this could drag on for months more, if not longer.
I think both sides are quite dug into their positions. What is very much needed is to see if there's anywhere where their interests might align, and that doesn't seem very likely, but of course it doesn't mean it shouldn't be tried. But yes, I fear that it is going to carry on for some time to come.
That was Ali Virgi, a researcher on African issues at the University of London. He's also a non-resident senior advisor on Africa and peace initiatives at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He was speaking from London with my colleague, Kate Bond-Dawson. In South Africa this weekend, political parties urged citizens to register to vote during local government elections scheduled for the 1st of November. Polls and political analysts predict the ruling African National Congress, racked by crisis after crisis, is going to lose power in several cities. Darren Taylor reports.
ANC leader and South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, was met by hostile crowds of protesters when he visited Soweto on Saturday. The Johannesburg township of more than a million inhabitants is traditionally an ANC stronghold. But years of poor service delivery from ANC councillors have left residents angry and frustrated. Joseph Tlele says his local councillor, called Tulani, has been promising him electricity and water for years.
We are tired of these lies from these people. We want the president here. We don't want to speak to Tulani anymore. We want the president here. This is our right. We are tired of these things that these guys are doing to us. They just want to be clean. They are lying day and night with us. Yesterday, there was some...
Eager to win votes for his beleaguered party, Ramaphosa promised the demonstrators that contractors would arrive within days to begin electrifying areas that haven't had power since the ANC was first elected 27 years ago. But some residents said they'd heard such promises before from the ANC, and they didn't trust Ramaphosa. This woman says, "No, I won't register to vote." In 2016, the ANC also promised to make our lives better, but things just got worse here. In response to the protests against the party, ANC spokesperson Pule Mabe said it was irresponsible not to vote.
When you don't vote in your own ward, it is not the ANC you are dealing with. You are dealing with yourself, because the delivery of services done through an ANC councillor impacts on your own living condition. If you are so willing that you can give away the livelihood of a community where you stay because there are disputes, then you must be comfortable being led by different people in your own community.
Mabe remained confident that the ANC would maintain its hold on municipalities such as Soweto, despite the obvious failings of its councillors.
It is going to be these comrades of the African National Congress who are going to have to lead their localities and continue doing the good work that the ANC was doing.
Across the country, in order to keep or to gain lucrative jobs as ANC councillors, vicious and sometimes deadly intra-party battles have erupted, especially in the province of KwaZulu-Natal. Violence monitor Mary De Haas says political assassinations are happening regularly in the run-up to the elections, like a recent case on the south coast.
The local successful candidate was almost killed because there were gunmen outside her house. Her brother was killed, and a friend of his, who is a witness in the criminal case against the councillor, was stabbed and is in a serious condition in hospital. So this is the sort of tension we've got brewing at the moment.
De Haas isn't shocked that some ANC councillors who fear they'll lose to rivals within the party in the battle to get onto candidate lists are resorting to violence.
There's a huge amount at stake there because these people, most of them would be unemployable if they weren't councillors. They're losing a hefty salary, they're losing perks, bodyguards, they're losing, of course, tender opportunities. So that's what it's all about. I mean, we've known this for years, and the sad thing is that so little has been done about it.
Political analysts say the only way the ANC will be able to cling on to a measure of power in several cities will be to form coalitions with other parties. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The Zimbabwe government says all civil servants should be vaccinated before they can come to work. This has sparked mixed reactions among the working class. Reporter Kuzazi Nwashi has the details.
Monica Mutswangwa is the Minister of Information. She announced the new government stance towards unvaccinated civil servants at a post-cabinet media briefing.
Pursuant to the previous announcement that all civil servants should be vaccinated, Cabinet further resolved that no unvaccinated civil servants will be allowed to come to work.
Vivid Gwede is a political analyst. He tells VOA how the new proclamation stands to infringe on people's rights.
The issue of the vaccine must remain within the zones of encouragement, not coercion. People have a fundamental right to make a decision about their bodies. There are people who genuinely, because of their status or their current conditions, cannot take the vaccine. And that shouldn't be a reason to exclude them from working for the government or going back to work.
Obet Masaraure is the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe. He tells VOA the new declaration will face resistance.
The move by the government to try to bar unvaccinated civil servants from working is unconstitutional, and it will be resisted politically and legally. The attempts at coercion will be resisted, and if they are going to fail, we will not allow the working class to be abused by the government of the day.
Masaraure says government should focus its efforts on raising awareness of the vaccine and addressing any concerns unvaccinated civil servants may have. Critics worry the segregation will continue to the private sector if not challenged. For many civil servants still on the fence about getting the jab will find themselves in a dilemma: getting the jab and remain employed or going jobless. For VOA, this is Kudzai Nawashe from Harare.
More than 850 former Boko Haram fighters and their family members who escaped from the jihadist group to Cameroon have left northern Cameroon for Nigeria. Nigerian authorities say they are taking the former militants to Nigerian disarmament centers after complaints that such centers in Cameroon were overwhelmed by the number of former jihadists defecting since the terrorist group's leader was declared killed in May. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Mora on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria.
Hundreds of people Saturday gathered along streets, watching and waving as 20 buses transporting former Boko Haram militants and their families left Mora, a town on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, for Bangui, a town in Nigeria's Borno state. The governor of Cameroon's far north region, Mijiyawa Bakari, says the former militants agreed to voluntarily return to Nigeria.
Ici, il s'agit des repentis, c'est-à-dire ceux-là même qui ont été prisonniers de Boko Haram.
Bakari says the ex-Boko Haram militants who have agreed to return to Nigeria's Borno state are Nigerian citizens, 854 of them, which also include their families. He says they told Cameroonian government officials that they were either fighters or slaves on plantations controlled by the jihadist group. Bakari says the Nigerian ex-fighters promised to be good citizens of Borno State. Bakari said about 150 more former militants who are of Nigerian nationality will return to their country in the weeks ahead, but he did not explain why they are not returning now. A majority of the ex-militants are women and children. Cameroon said more about 320 males, including young boys among them, are former fighters of the jihadist group. 80 are females, the terrorist group used as spies in localities they attacked, authorities said. 454 others are their family members. 34-year-old Kadir Hassan says he is spokesperson of the former Boko Haram militants who agreed to return to Nigeria. He escaped from the Sambisa forest, a Boko Haram stronghold, on the Cameroon-Nigerian border in August. The former fighter says he is looking forward to meeting his relatives in Kukawa, a town in Nigeria's Borno state. Hassan says he left Kukawa to join the jihadist group in March 2020. Hassan says many Cameroonians and Nigerians he saw in the Sambisa forest want to leave Boko Haram, but are afraid that fighters will kill them. He says he is pleading with the multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin that is fighting the jihadist group to help people who are still under Boko Haram captivity and want to leave. He says the ex-combatants pledge to contribute to the development of their communities when they return to Nigeria. The task force, made up of troops from Niger, Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria, said it took the surrendered Boko Haram militants to demobilization centers called DDRs in Meri and Meme, Cameroonian towns on the border with Nigeria. In August, Cameroon said it was negotiating to return the ex-militants to Nigeria as the DDR centers were becoming overcrowded. Lawan Abba Wakilbi, Nigeria's Borno State Commissioner for Education, represented the government of Nigeria at the ceremony to hand over the former militants. He says the former militants will be kept at rehabilitation centers in Bangui, Nigeria.
We are going to rehabilitate them and we'll reintegrate them into the society. You see, taking this number away from Boko Haram has given them a shortage in manpower. We are happy and would like to use this opportunity to thank the Cameroonian government for keeping and handing them over to us.
Cameroon says former militants still at the demobilization centers on its northern border with Nigeria and Chad include Chadians, Cameroonians, and Nigerians. Bakari said DDR centers in Cameroon's northern border will continue to receive militants and fighters who surrender and drop their weapons. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Mora, Northern Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America. We'll be right back.
The Voice of America's global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.